honorable guest, and also everyone who is here, including the media, who always with us. I'm told that here with us we've got the Association of Independent Publishers is here. Right to Know, they are here. Mixita, they are here. Competition Commission has already saw them. ICASA has already saw them. We are told also that MDDA is also here. If I didn't mention you and you are here, they will come to you so that you can be able to identify yourself. Maybe by way of opening, I would just like to welcome all of you, and again to those who have indicated or felt that the notice was too short, the invitation, we like to apologize in that regard. However, your response and attendance indicates the importance of this matter at hand and your commitment to finding a collective solution to the challenges regarding the issue of the print media transformation and diversity. Indeed, this meeting will be open to all South Africans, those who will be here and those who will be following through other channels, and is attended by quite a number of stakeholders, as I've indicated. The one which I mentioned are those who are going to make presentation, but we've got other bodies who have attended, like your press council and the ombudsman has indicated that they will attend, but they will not be making presentation, and others also are here. We think that this discussion should be able to help us in trying to determine in terms of how far have we went in terms of trying to deal with this difficult issue, which all sectors in the country are grappling with, of transformation. We hope that the presentation which you are going to make here today is going to assist us as a committee on future engagement with yourself and the government entities which has been entrusted with that responsibility in making sure that indeed we do transform this part, this sector. I must also say this gathering today is no means aimed at dealing with the media accountability mechanism. Of course, I've seen and be following in the media, there has been some indication that this gathering might or will be discussing that particular matter. Our focus today is on the transformation and diversity, nothing else. We are not dealing with the accountability mechanism of print media. Indeed, as you know, we hope that Parliament in due course will engage in that particular matter. And when that happens, you will be notified, and accordingly, presentation or invitation to that extent will be issued out. But it will be too early to deal with that now, because Parliament has still to engage in its own internal processes in determining the course of that particular matter. We hope that, again, this discussion today will assist us in strategically reviewing the development since 1994, assessing success stories, because of course there should be some positive developments, evaluating challenges inhibiting change in the public interest, develop ideas to enhance the transformation and the diversity in this space. Together we should look at the progress in this regard, challenges, what are the fundamental contributions that lead to the lack of transformation if we are still not doing it enough, what needs to be done, do we need a joint commitment by yourself as an industry in setting out specific targets that will ensure change happens in a pace which everyone will appreciate. Of course, we are basing some of these things from the Comtask report of 1996, which if you go through that particular report also raised certain issues which as a nation or as a sector we're supposed to focus at, so that we make sure that we deal with some of those issues which has been raised. Of course, there's been some research by MDDA of 2009, which also focused on the control. And media and the ownership, which also indicated that indeed there are some development, but still there are some concerns or a room for development, and many, many other research which has also revealed that indeed there are challenges. In particular, if you go through the Comtask report, at one point it made mention that in the value chain of this industry, there might be, I want to be, to select my wording carefully, possible anti-competitive behavior. At no means I'm saying it's like that. But the Comtask report highlighted that matter, that there might be those possibilities that that is happening, in particular on the print and distribution. I must also say that we hope, as I've indicated before, that this engagement then will also form a base of our ongoing discussion as we move forward. We hope as a committee that from today, from these 2 days after this engagement, we'll make sure that we also accommodate print media as part of our priorities, because like I'm saying, we have not been engaging that much. We engage, then there's a huge space in between of not engaging, then we'll come at a certain point. So we want to also to make sure that it becomes a continuous engagement, so that indeed we do understand each other and also the sector, how it operates. We hope that all of you will help us to understand and also provide some solutions on these issues which I've just raised. One other thing is that as I've indicated before, that normally we prefer, in particular this committee, to engage sectors, or so that we understand them. We have started with the advertising industry. We had our first engagement on the fourth quarter, which will be starting just right now in October. We will be making follow-up on the issues which we have raised with them. They'll be coming back to appear before the committee so that we take forward the issues we have raised. We hope that we follow the same with yourself, that after this engagement and after we've come up with how do we move forward, we will do the same. We'll create a space to engage yourself so that we understand each other, in particular in this forum, for the benefit of everyone. For those who have not interacted, some of you have requested meetings with myself. We have met, we have discussed. Those who so wish that they need to engage, they can do so, even the members of the committee, so that we create a vibrant relationship which will make us understand each other and also fast track the transformation of the sector itself. With that, I would think that we'll have to start. I know members, they've been unkind to me. The past 2 days has been hectic, and they've clearly indicated that we are pulling too hard. But all what I can say is that let's see, probably today we'll have an early break so that they are also able to rest. With that, I've got the Association of Independent Publishers ready to give us the first presentation. I'm told that the Right to Know is also ready. Mr. Hunter would then be able also to give us a presentation. KwaZulu-Natal Community Print Forum is also ready. But immediately after Mr. Hunter, we'll like to take MDPA to come in so that they are also able to give us the broader picture. And then we will follow with the rest as the readiness is being confirmed by some of you who are here. Over to you, Madam Vey. Madam Vey, if you can just use the mic.
Good morning. I'm going to concentrate on a description of the sector, of the independent publisher sector, as I think it's largely one that is unknown to the broader public, and also concentrate on answering questions, which I will welcome. It will not be a long presentation. I hope you have copies in front of you. Have the copies been copied around? There's also an appendix of figures. I think I'd like to start by saying there are about 230 independent publishers operating presently in the South African community. About 10 to 15 of those are in SADC countries, Botswana, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Zimbabwe specifically. The remainder operate within South Africa. I think that the best way to define them is that there are three different communities of interest. We call ourselves independent grassroots community media, as opposed to purely community media. Because these newspapers are owned by people in the communities in which they serve, and they are not funded by any organizations, unless the MBDA in terms of emerging, but I'll get onto that. And they work very hard at surviving. It is a knife edge out there. So there are 230 papers. I think there are three types of communities we can look at. The traditional, the communities of language, there are quite a few members of the AIP that publish in different languages. So we have Isixhosa papers, Sesotho papers, Arabic papers, and a whole lot of papers that work in different languages. So those we call communities of language. They're not necessarily geographical. For example, Dizendaba News, which operates in the Western Cape, operates across various communities, Khayelitsha and other communities, but is aimed specifically at the Xhosa-speaking people of the Western Cape. And 30% of their news comes from the Eastern Cape. So you can see it's a very specific type of niche market. The second kind of community we have is the communities of interest. For example, there are Muslim newspapers, Jewish newspapers, newspapers that are Chimurenga, which is an arts and culture magazine, Amandla, which is a workers magazine, and those kinds of communities. The third kind of community is the traditional community that one thinks of when one talks about a community newspaper, and that is the geographical community. And it is the predominant type of newspaper that operates in AIP. Our communities vary. They operate across the country from Jozini down to Gansbaai, from Upington to the Eastern Cape. They are in all those areas. They primarily service rural and disadvantaged communities and have done so. It's their primary market. Some of them are 140 years old. Some are as young as 6 months old. And some of what I've been on site visits across the country. I've been into shacks, I've been into Zozo huts, I've been into unused classrooms, I've been into three-story buildings, I've seen one-person operations and 30 people operations. So that is the extent and the sort of difference of the types of community of newspapers that are out there. And I think that's the basic discussion. The AIP has been going since 2005. It's the only industry body that is there to represent these small independent newspapers. And it's also very difficult to represent the newspapers because they are so far-flung and isolated. And also because there is not a great deal of money in the area. Approximately 80 of the AIP members are emerging publications, and about 40 of those are funded by the MDDA. A conservative weekly readership of AIP readership is 6 million. If one takes a conservative figure or takes the common wisdom number of 6 readers per issue. However, if you look at the AMP surveys, which have been looked at, which have been used in certain other media houses, you could look at 14 to 10 readers per issue, which means then they'll be looking at a weekly readership of between 6 to 13 million readers per week. So it's not an area to be sneezed at in terms of readership. Another crude estimate is that these publications create about 4,000 jobs and contributed 210 million turnover annually to the South African economy. These are the SMMEs out there, and yet they are receiving absolutely no support in terms of SMME development or support, like any kind of support from the DTI or any of those. It's difficult to look at the data. AIP was first registered in 2005, and its first database was only developed in 2006. We're in the process of updating that our database at the moment. Verification is quite difficult. There is another database that we've also used to look at the figures, and that is the Community Advertising Procurement Agency's database, which represents only some of the independent media. And if we look at that, what we are looking at is that in terms of the CAPRO database, since 2000, 31 of those have at least have been bought out by the large media houses, and about 22 have closed. Beyond that, another 20 on our databases have indicated that they have had to close. I have done the ownership breakdown in 2000, but what I'd like to kind of concentrate on now is the ownership in 2011. In 2011, AIP data indicated a significant change in the nature of the grassroots print media. And if you look at this document, which is an appendix that was hopefully handed out, you will see that ownership is about 50% white and 50% black. Language usage is 44% English only, to about 28% English and Afrikaans combined, and another 27% use indigenous languages plus English and Afrikaans or two indigenous languages or more. And then, as I said before, the weekly print run is about 1.1 million, which means a readership of at least 6.6 million. If you take AMP's figures that are used elsewhere, then we're looking at another. We're looking at a possible 10 to 13 million on a weekly basis, and that does not include the fortnightly and monthly figures. Most of the AIP members are too small to have to conform with the BEE codes. It was a turnover of less than the minimum. The MDDA has been important in assisting to develop the small independent media, but as I said, out of the 230, 40 presently are being funded by the MDDA. And I think I'd like to just finish very briefly there, just to say those are the basic facts and figures of the sector, and I would like to welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was short. I'm sure all presentation, if can be short, as yours will be here at out here of at 2, and then we don't have to be here for 2 days. Thanks very much for the clear and understandable presentation. Members? Honorable Kille? Rochen?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to know, if we look at this, this picture before us, what was also presented to us before by the MDDA is the it's a problem of establishment and then continuing as a business after some support was in fact obtained, financial support from the MDDA. I just want to ask the 40 newspapers that are to being funded by the MDDA. What is the period of the funding, and what is the nature of skills transfer, also as far as management of those papers are concerned? And secondly, what are the possibilities? Because largely, it is very important for them to obtain opportunities for cheap print, and the volume sometimes actually inhibit that. The economies of scale is a problem. What efforts are made to assist them in trying to establish sort of print agreements with institutions that would make it more possible to afford it, affordability issues? Lastly, to what extent do they have any advertisements from government for positions, local positions in areas that are being advertised, vacancies for school principals, etc.? To what extent are they being supported? Because obviously advertising is also a very critical component of any funding model of these community print media. Thank you.
Trochen.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you for this presentation. I'm sorry I missed your role in the IP. Can you just, I would like to know if you can clarify your role, please. And then I haven't get any documents for me to study them. So it's better for me then to ask these questions. So it's a pity for me that I couldn't prepare. If I look at the schedule, there's no mention made of women. Are there women working for you, journalists, women? Are they working then for you? And how many are there? And then MDDA has no mention made of them. So how could small newspapers, if the MDDA wasn't there, how would they be able to exist if the MDDA wasn't there? So I would like to ask, you visit, like you said, some of you see some of them are small companies, some of them are big, and their staff component, but what would you like to see? We know the paper is expensive, the print media is expensive, some of them can't afford it. And if you look at the affordability, what would like what would you like to see in the newspapers? And then, you know, email is taking over this, and we need to know that some people in the rural area do not have access to emails and then to the electronic media. So how can you make sure that our children in the rural areas and the youth have access to these internet facilities if they do not get these newspapers? What would you like to see in the future? Thanks.
Thank you.
If you can respond.
Yeah, thanks. I'll answer your first question. I should speak to you first. I'm the executive director of the Association of Independent Publishers. Okay, thanks. And I used to run a community newspaper in Grahamstown for 7 years. So that's my background in terms of that. The issue of sustainability is a major issue in terms of the small and independent newspapers, and in particularly at the moment, in the last 2 or 3 years, it's become particularly difficult. I think in terms of the MDDA, I'm trying to think of all the MDDA questions. I'm sure that they will be there to answer them later, but in terms of my experience and understanding, the MDDA has been funding people for 1 year, particularly for printing costs in some cases for more than that. However, they are revisiting their policy in terms of long-term sustainability, because it looks like, it seems to be that a once-off 1 year funding model is not necessarily the most successful. So that is an issue that's being looked at. The other thing that the MBDA has been doing, I think in conjunction with some of the small-time publishers and other organizations, is to negotiate bulk printing costs or specific prices for community newspapers. It still represents one of its biggest costs. In fact, the printing costs of a small-time newspaper is one of its major costs, and then the other is, of course, staffing, depending on how big, whether it's a one-person operation or not. So that is a major issue. The government advertising, it does differ from community to community, but there seems to be, on a general, you might get some municipal advertising within the local newspaper, depending on the relationship between the, or the understanding too, between the municipality and the newspaper servicing that particular community. But national and provincial advertising, very little of that appears in the local community newspapers, which in my experience is problematic. I can remember that the Department of Health, for example, in the Eastern Cape was holding immunization campaigns. They came to the local newspapers and said they had no advertising, please would they run free stories, which one does as a social responsibility, but it's not the way to go. What one needs is a full page ad indicating exactly when the clinic is open, which immunizations, what needs to be brought, when and why, and therefore. And those are the kinds of things that it would be really great to see in those community newspapers, not only for the sustainability of those newspapers to reach the very people that need to be reached, in terms of those immunization campaigns. So very little national and provincial and district advertising, government advertising, goes into the local, into the independent publishers. Is that everything that I needed to ask in terms of that? The other times, okay, just in terms of the long-term sustainability of a paper, and this happens to whether your paper is 140 years old or a six-month newspaper that has just been started out and supported by the MBDA. Long-term sustainability is an issue, and it continues to be an issue, particularly in the present times. It's very difficult for the sector to get national advertising from the retail businesses and people like that, I think often because the larger media and advertising landscape doesn't understand the sector and doesn't understand what its figures look like and what it can do and whom it reaches. Often the discussion is about living standard measures, which is valid, I suppose, but when you develop working within a particular geographical community, you are servicing everybody in that community, from the poorest of the poor to the richest of the rich. So your LSM is 1 to 10. The same thing is also true when you're looking at a community of language or a community of interest. So, for example, possibly the whole Muslim community reads a particular Muslim newspaper. It doesn't matter what their LSM is. So it's very difficult to get government, district, national and provincial government advertising for these small newspapers. It's also very difficult to get the normal retail advertising. And as the movement of other media organizations into this particular field grows, it's become more difficult because it is difficult to kind of match advertising rates and things like that. The other thing about the printing is that there are very few independent printing organizations out there. And so we rely again on the main media houses. As I say, there have been some very positive developments in terms of negotiations around prices, but it is a difficulty again that you are not caught, but that the only places that you can go to are people that you might be working in competition with, or see themselves as working in competition with you, or it's little choice. For example, in Mpumalanga, there is only one printing organization one can go to. And in Bloemfontein, and in the Free State, it's true of that as well. I think that I have dealt with some of the questions around sustainability. What would I like to see? I think that I've indicated that the independent publishers would like to see more government advertising and support such as that going. It's not support. It's actually using the papers to reach the very people that the government advertising should be reaching. So it's not about support. It's about using a product that is out there and reaching the very people that you want to reach. The electronic media, I think this is one of the big reasons why community or independent grassroots newspapers are important, because they reach the very people that do not have access to electronic media or to those such opportunities. I also think that this is the only place in the independent grassroots media, it's the only place where you can get your hyper-local news, where you can find out about what your community is up to and what it is doing. Because these independent newspapers do, that's what they deal with, that is what they report on. You can get your provincial and your national news and your international news on radio and TV and in the national and provincial newspapers, but there's only the local newspaper in which you can get your local news, and it's that which makes them still so in demand. I know that various newspapers are working on, say, websites and things like that. They might be setting up communication centres within their own newspapers where people can access the internet. I don't know that it's necessarily there. Particular brief to provide internet access to communities, but I know several newspapers which do work in connection with such organizations to try and provide that. I think one of the most successful ways forward, given the use of cell phones in this country, is to connect these local independent newspapers, hyper-local news, with Mobi sites. Can you imagine the kind of success of an immunization campaign that has an advert, a full-page advert, in a local newspaper, and then on top of that it's sent out over the telephone through a Mobi site to everyone that is affected. So those are the kinds of things I think that can be done. I think that it is, that those are the kinds of things that can be done, that we need to look at reaching the right people through the right media, or reaching the people that need to be met through the right media, and in the right languages.
and in the right spaces.
Follow up? Oh no, it's fine. No.
Sorry, on the question on the women. On the women.
Honorable Drogen, I've seen your hand and I noted you. Madame Killen and Honorable Van der Berg. Follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I don't know what makes Honorable Van der Berg honorable and me a madam, but be that as it may. Chairperson, I just wanted to ask Ms. Vail the following. Government is currently, through the GCIS, publishing the Vukuzenzela in 11 languages. We have not engaged, not that I'm aware of, the chairperson, with them to determine the distribution of the print. And obviously, it's part of our oversight to determine to what extent it is reaching the communities that it is intended for, apart from the fact that we have criticism from a political perspective about utilizing public funds for a newspaper that could be a propaganda arm of government. Apart from that, I'm ready to park that. I want to know from a point of view of distribution of a print that is monthly done, to what extent would the community, the independent community papers, be in a position to distribute that? And secondly, what do you suggest should be done to make sure that these papers, which are clearly fulfilling a very important role in the different communities that they serve, that they are actually put in touch with government authorities to make sure that government makes better, in all spheres, make better use of media, to the extent that perhaps some of the information could go through these institutions to assist with the transformation and diversity in media, instead of running a separate newspaper as a government, because it is about local services for the communities, for rural areas. Information about government services, which is a document that is published centrally, could hardly really fulfill the needs of local communities because it does not have specifics about clinics opening times. For instance, it's calling on pensioners, it's winter is coming up, go to your local clinic, the necessary medication is there to help protect you, etc. To what extent do you think the MBDA could fulfill this role, and what steps have you taken as the AIP to actually engage government at different levels to make sure that you really become the voice of the people in the community, but also distributing information to people who really need it? I hear the issue about the role of broadband, but we have to understand that for some time still, vast sections of our community are so desperate for information in print form. So that is still a critical role in South Africa. And to what extent can we actually make people have a communication with them that will help them to make choices, also to have advertisements, etc.? And how will we succeed in achieving that? Thank you.
Honorable Drogen.
Thank you, Chairperson. I didn't have a follow-up question. I think the speaker missed my question, the number of women.
Yeah.
But I want to change my question, the number of women working with the newspapers and then the number of women membership of need to be part of that schedule. In addition to that, the number of people with disabilities that are journalists working for the newspapers and as well as members. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Jefferson. Just whose responsibility is it really for the small local newspapers to survive. It's just a business. People like your fish and chips, or they don't like your fish and chips, and then they don't buy fish and chips at your shop. Or they like your newspaper, or they don't like your newspaper, and they don't read it. And I think we are moving into a day, there will be a lot of pointing fingers today. You're responsibility for that, and it's your fault, and that and the other thing. So if you want to get your business on track, you have to market yourself. Go out in the community and look for advertisements or whatever, people to support. You can't sit there in the corner and wait for everything to happen. That's all. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. You must switch off your mic if you are not... they are indicating that it's difficult to record if two mics are on at the same time. The system... It's struggling. I hope it's not digital yet, it's still analog. Because I'm told digital, you can have multiple of doing a lot of things at once. So this one, I think, is still analog. That's why it's struggling if two mics are on and on. But you can respond to the questions which has been raised. But the one which I wanted to check with you is that when GCIS presented their report, I just can't recall when, but they indicated a certain percentage on how much government has spent to local media, both print and broadcasting. And because I'm just following up your question of government not utilizing, which I agree to a certain extent, but what extent is the opposite? Utilizing the print media, the local newspapers, but government. When I was comparing government, I'm sure that around it was more than 40% of the budget, which went to local. But the opposite, we didn't have the information at hand to indicate exactly how much has been spent. Do you have any idea, maybe to that regard?
I deal with the last question first. Okay, I think it's the definition of local or community that needs to be looked at in terms of that. As I said, I think that the independent publisher sector, that various parts of the community call their papers community newspapers. You've got community newspapers right across the board from the big media houses as well as the independent publishers. I think if you look at that, you'll mostly find it's a definition of what community is as to where that government advertising is going.
Why does that confusion?
As I said to you earlier, I think there's not an understanding of this particular independent publishing sector. It has been quiet. It is a far-flung newspapers and individuals. They find it difficult to come together. And I think that possibly at the moment with the NVDA support and the institutionalization of AIP, you are beginning to get a sector that can speak with one voice. Up until now, it has been a sector which is very isolated and far-flung and not come together. Okay, thanks. In terms of women and disabilities, this is the kind of research we really need to work on. I know that there are women owners of newspapers, and I also have seen many women journalists working in the newspapers. I cannot give you figures on disability or all women, but this is the kind of ongoing research we really need to do within the sector. In terms of Vukuzenzele, I gather there will be a tender put out at the end of the year asking for people to tender for distribution. The small local newspapers will be doing that to look at the inserting the Vukuzenzele into their own newspapers to distribute it. I've given you weekly print figures. I haven't given you monthly print figures. You can add a further 800,000 if you look at the monthly print figures to that figure of 1.1 million. Some of them are magazines, though, Not all our newspapers. I have examples here, but there will be sufficient to go across the country. In terms of actually putting the editorial material into the independent newspapers rather than into Vuku Zelizele, the arguments, there could be arguments both ways. It is very useful to have the editorial material in the local newspaper, which gives you your specifics in terms of times and dates and addresses and things like that. However, you can do it through, and we've done this before with the Legal Aid Board in an insert called Know Your Rights, where it was developed in four different languages, distributed across the country, and there's only one page for change, and that was the local details change. So sometimes you can go that route, sometimes you can go the other route of actually paying for advertorial or editorial within the local newspapers. So I think that's the way that one could deal with Vuku Zenzele. I mean, I think that the local government authorities making better use of the media, I think that is around the understanding of the media, developing relationships within the media. I think it also depends on what type, on how much, on the communication staff in a particular area, whether the positions are filled, whether people are available, and all those kinds of issues as well. In terms of whose responsibility for these papers to exist, obviously they are businesses. But you do look at enabling environments or disenabling environments, and I think at the moment what we're looking at is we don't have a particularly enabling environment for the development of local or for the sustainability of independent publishers out there. And if we are looking at different voices and the and media diversity, then the independent publishers in many ways are the face of that of media development and diversity, and an enabling environment is all that is one is expects as one does in any kind of economic situation. Obviously, an economic recession that hits right across the country and hits everybody will hit those people as well, and one doesn't ask for special favors for any particular business, but I think when what one does ask for is a fair chance at being able to operate in a particular environment. There are several members of the independent publishers sitting here in the audience, and the KZN grouping are also independent publishers, so I think you can also hear quite a lot from those people themselves. Have I covered everything? Oh, in terms of advertising from the community, when you are looking at servicing the particularly poor and disadvantaged communities, there's often not a lot of local advertising that one can get from that community. And when you're not able to access the retail advertising, even though you might have big chains of stores within that community, but those chains do not advertise in a local community newspaper often, even though they those people are buying from their particular shop. And local people, such as the local spaza's shop or the local butcher or the local bakery, often don't think about advertising, don't have advertising budgets, and people do go out and work with them, but people are working on a knife edge, and particularly in those kinds of communities in which the majority of the independent publishers operate.
Thank you, madam. One other person.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned the Department of Health. Wanted free ad. Let me. Woman, Rishina. Okay. I'd like to know. The local government, like the mayor's office and municipalities, are they using the community newspapers to inform what is happening within the community? We get community newspapers, but we like to hear what is happening in the municipality, you know, those types of things. Do they make use of these community newspapers? Thank you.
It depends on communities. It changes from community to community. There are municipalities who do use the local newspaper a lot, There are municipalities who remove their advertising from the newspaper because it's too critical. And we've had incidences of that. So I think it depends largely on the relationship between the two newspapers and the understanding of the municipality and the local community. The mayor and individuals in terms of their response to the local media. So it varies. It really does vary quite broadly.
Thank you very much, Mr. For your presentation and your response to the question which members have asked. I don't know what's the definition of tiny little question, but you can ask.
I just wanted to have a better understanding. Obviously, we're going to engage with the MDDA on this as well. But the type of funding, is the funding specifically aimed at empowerment as well, also business development? Because I just wanted to make sure that we understand if we can direct the funds to have the correct outcome, then maybe we can assist. Sorry, I did forget to answer that question. With funding goes training. And for example, at the moment, the MDDA is developing a governance training kit because that kind of issue, those kinds of formalities are difficult. But there are other trainings, advertising training and things like that. So there is a skills development. I do have copies of some of these papers here. I've brought them to show off. So if anybody wants to have a look at some of these community newspapers, they are here.
Honorable Van der Berg will be happy, always wants to see, feel and touch the newspaper. So you can see, feel and touch them.
I obviously haven't bought all of them, but I bought you a sample.
Thanks very much, Ms. Vane, for your presentation. Right to know, are you ready? Mr. Hunter. They've written Mr. here, but I only see ladies approaching. What has happened here? Apology. I was just reading what is before me. If you may introduce yourself and then you take us through your presentation.
Apologies, we'll just be 2 minutes, we're just setting up. For the opportunity to do this presentation. Needless to say, I'm not Mr. Hunter from the Right to Know campaign. My name is Jane Duncan from Rhodes University, but today I'm representing the Right to Know campaign. And my colleague is Julie Reed from the Department of Communications at UNISA. What we are doing is we're doing a presentation which is by the Media Freedom and Diversity Working Group of the Right to Know campaign. Now, I think that the Right to Know campaign has been particularly well known for the work that it's done around the Protection of the Information Bill. But it's also been doing work on media freedom and media diversity issues as well, and we would like to present some of the thinking around those particular issues. But first of all, before we do the presentation, we just want to raise a process point. And the point we want to raise is that the Constitution obviously places an obligation on all organs of state, including Parliament, to facilitate public participation. And we don't think that this indaba has been organized in such a way that actually fulfills that constitutional obligation of encouraging public participation. For one thing, the invitation has been too short to actually facilitate participation, and we're concerned about who has been invited and who's not been invited to this particular indaba, and we're concerned because of that about the inclusivity of the indaba. And I think if the work of the indaba is going to continue, then we need an inclusive public process. I've heard the apology from the chair, and the apology is acknowledged, but we just wanted to register our objection at the way that this indaba has actually been called up. Having said that, I just want to make a few introductory comments about the Right to Know campaign, which was established in August 2010. And it's had endorsements since then by over 400 organizations and 11,000 individuals. It has elected structures in all those provinces. In fact, a couple of days ago, the Eastern Cape structure was launched in Grahamstown. And in just over a year, what we can say we've achieved is we've campaigned successfully to have the Protection of Information Bill, or what euphemistically called the Secrecy Bill, reopened for further consultation. Now, this is the campaign vision, which I won't read, but I think it should give an indication of the fact that we're also concerned about creating enabling conditions in South Africa for the free flow of information, which obviously means that we have to get into questions of media diversity and media transformation. That flows logically from our mandate. Now, the one thing we do have to just flag right up front is that we're still developing positions in this particular area. We have had a summit, and there was a summit resolution that called for adequate and sustainable funding for community media and the NGDA, a rejection of statutory regulation of the print media. But it also called for measures as well to limit media concentration, and there were a number of other proposals specifically relating to broadcasting that I won't necessarily go into. Now, how do we define media transformation? Obviously, we're not going to be able to have a sensible discussion until we've got a common understanding of what we mean by transformation.
And we found quite a useful definition of transformation that came out of a series of academic debates that happened in the late 1990s about to what extent had the media at that stage transformed. And this definition was developed by two academics, Ron Krebel and Mashilo Boloka, who's now with the DRC. It was developed in 2000. And it goes, successful transformation will be achieved when the media reflects in its ownership, staffing, and products, the society within which it operates, not only in terms of race, but also socioeconomic status, gender, religion, sexual orientation, region, language, etc. This is only possible if access is opened, again, in ownership, staffing, and product, not only to the emerging black elite, but also to grassroots communities of all colors. And we're using that as a guiding definition to assess to which, the extent to which the media has actually transformed. Now, there's also, before we get into that assessment, there's a number of preliminary remarks that we'd like to make. Firstly, I think there can be little doubt that newspapers are largely on the cutting edge of journalism in South Africa. Most of the really significant investigative stories of the past few years have been broken by newspapers. Most of the awards for excellence in journalism have also gone to newspaper journalists. Now, one of the reasons why this has happened is because the major newspaper groups have reinvested in investigative journalism capacity. Now, this kind of journalism should be recognized and celebrated as an essential pillar of democracy. We must defend the space for newspapers to continue to do this work on pure democratic grounds. Now, having said that, it's also necessary for us to assess the extent of transformation of the industry. And I think we need to do so dispassionately, which may be difficult in this current climate, because there's obviously quite a lot of emotion about this around this particular issue. And this is because media freedom and media transformation for us are two sides of the same coin. Without media freedom, the media will be untransformed, as it will become the voice of the state or even the ruling party. But without media transformation, media freedom will become the freedom enjoyed by the few. So for us, we need to pay attention to media freedom and media transformation in equal measure, as they are interdependent concepts. Now, just in terms of the question of media diversity and the extent to which the newspaper industry is concentrated, there was a period in the late 1990s when the print media began to diversify quite significantly. Whole new layers of owners were introduced, including black empowerment groups, trade unions, and women's groups. There was significant transformation on the level of staffing and audiences. But in the early 2000s, the print media started to reconsolidate. And we now have a situation where one large group dominates, which is Media 24, NASPAS, followed by three smaller groups. These are the circulation figures from the NDDA report. Apologies, slightly out of date, but that should give you an indication of where we stand with regards to control of total newspaper circulation. Now, newspapers are spread unevenly across the country. They tend to publish largely in English and to a lesser extent in Afrikaans, with the possible exception of the tabloids. Now, this means that upper working class and middle class audiences are prioritized in the main. Now, these are some of the transformation challenges that we obviously need to grapple with in the next 2 days. Now, South Africa's newspaper market is clearly not as concentrated as Australia's, where two groups dominate 90% of the market. The South African market is veering dangerously towards excessively high levels of concentration, and the dominance of Media 24 should be of particular concern. Now, why should we be concerned? We should be concerned for democratic reasons. Concentration can lead to the following. It can lead to a reduction in the plurality of media outlets and diversity of opinion. The homogenization of media content. The prioritization of views from the elite minority. And the dominance of commercial interests over the public interest. We need to be concerned about these things. Think about it for a minute. What if at some stage in the future Media 24 decided to sell its newspapers and the Murdoch group decided to buy them? We'll be in trouble. Now, just reflecting on some of the arguments that have been made in media policy circles about how to measure excessively high levels of concentration. There's obviously a lot of disagreement about this particular point. So for instance, some countries have developed a number of voices tests or a diversity point system. There's also been an argument that if one group owns more than 25% of the market, then it should be considered excessively concentrated. Alternatively, a media economics theorist, Eli Noam, has suggested that a market with fewer than four voices with a market share of 20% each should be considered concentrated. France, for instance, has legislated against excessive concentration, and it has legislation that prevents ownership of more than 30% of circulation. And I think it's these kinds of things that you as legislators need to debate. How do we define an excessive level of concentration? The further point that I'd like to make as well is that it's perfectly permissible on democratic grounds for legislators to intervene in media ownership levels to ensure diversity, as this creates an enabling environment for the exercise of freedom of expression. Legislators can do this, but it is not permissible on democratic grounds to control media content. This is something that legislators cannot do on constitutional grounds. Now, we'd just like to make a couple of points about the extent of print media group's compliance with the BBBEE scorecards. Now, just doing an overview of the seven elements of the BBBEE scorecard, it's evident that the performance of the industry is patchy. There's a book chapter that we've distributed on the state of print media transformation, and there's a table in there that compares and contrasts the scorecards of the different media groups. So the detailed analysis is there. Now, if one takes level three to be the threshold for what one considers to be fair performance in terms of the scorecard, only Avusa meets the target. The other groups are either level four or level five contributors. Two of the four groups are entirely white-owned. All of the groups have scored extremely well on enterprise development and socioeconomic development, but the performance on employment equity is patchy and generally poor on skills development. But at the same time, the scores are generally strong on management and control. Now, this performance could lead one to argue that the industry is largely black controlled, as the major companies are management controlled. So black people control policy and operational issues, in these companies. But it could also be argued that the allocative control exercised by shareholders may be even more fundamental to the long-term direction of a company than operational control, as the shareholders have the power to remove the directors if they do not act in the company's best interest. So in other words, this does not remove the problem of white ownership in the industry. And the problem remains just that, a problem that needs to be addressed for democratic reasons. So in relation to content transformation, the triple BWE scorecards are obviously generic measurement tools and are unable to speak to the complexity of transformation challenges in newspaper organizations, especially on the all-important level of editorial content. So scorecards can only give us part of the picture. Now, I spoke earlier about the newspaper group's reinvestment in investigative journalism capacity. Now, this suggests a renewed commitment on the part of newspaper groups to reinvest in quality content. But there are other trends as well, particularly in the wake of the global recession, that are impacting negatively on media diversity as a component of transformation. So for instance, we've seen a centralization of newsrooms to reduce costs. A retrenchment of staff, including editorial staff. This has led journalists to be under tremendous pressure in newsrooms because they've been forced to do more with less. We're seeing the repurposing of content for multiple platforms, an increasing reliance on news agency copy, and Media Tenor has done some work on this particular issue. Also, and this came out in the report commissioned by the Sunday Times into editorial weaknesses in the newspaper in 2008, top-heavy organizational structures with a lack of investment in news generation. And certainly in that case, it allowed key checks and balances to lapse. Also, in some cases, we've seen a migration of papers towards upper LSMs to tap into more economically viable audiences. So, if one can generalize, while the groups are investing in investigative centers of excellence, at times, the rest of the newsroom is being cut to the bare bones. And these trends are impacting negatively on diversity of viewpoints in the affected publications. Now, we just want to make some remarks on the state of the community and small commercial print sector, because for us, there's real cause for concern there. Now, in spite of the fact that newspapers are said to be dying, there's a real energy in this sector, and potentially it could blossom into something very significant. So for example, in the Eastern Cape, I learned quite recently of a network of papers, 16 papers, that's publishing in isiXhosa. In Mpumalanga and Limpopo, we're seeing an efflorescence of grassroots papers springing up. But it also seems fair to say that there's also a dark cloud that's hanging over the sector. And we've heard from the AIP that they have lost a lot of members recently, particularly in the wake of the global recession. Now, they've attributed that in 2010 to shrinking advertising revenues and rising production costs. But also, a key aggravating factor has been the inability to compete with the big four groups, especially Caxton and Media 24, that are particularly active in the community newspaper sector. These groups enjoy competitive advantages because they are vertically and horizontally integrated, and they command the lion's share of advertising, especially national advertising, making barriers to entry extremely difficult for these groups. Now, we think that the committee needs to pay particular attention to these problems and what to do about them. Now, there's a deep sense of grievance that we've come to learn about amongst these community and small commercial newspapers about what they perceive to be the unfair competitive environment. Now, rightfully, the competition authorities are the correct forum to deal with these problems. But these groups experience problems even when they attempt to take cases to the competition tribunal and the commission. Now, one of the problems that they experience is that it's difficult for small media to stay the course when they take a complaint. By the time a case is investigated, the paper may have already closed. And a case in point is a particular newspaper in Volcom, whose case is being investigated at the moment by the Competition Commission, but it's already closed. Also, it's difficult to afford the legal fees to continue with a case, while the larger groups have deep pockets and can therefore out-lawyer the smaller groups. But there's also more substantial problems with relying on competition law to realize diversity. And here I just want to reflect on some of the debates that are taking place internationally amongst media activists and media policymakers around the adequacy of competition law in realizing media diversity. We obviously haven't taken positions on this particular issue, but I just want to reflect some of the debates that are going on. Now, one of the points that's made is that competition law is often not very effective in addressing social concerns in the media, such as the negative democratic effects of a group being able to dominate public opinion and the impact that this has on the democratic process. This is because competition law applies economic criteria to assess the negative effects of dominance rather than social criteria. Also, competition authorities would consider abuse of dominance to be socially detrimental, whereas media activists would consider dominance per se to be socially detrimental. Also, measurements of dominance in the economy generally and in the media will probably differ because of the peculiar needs of the media sector for plurality. Now, a key discussion point for Parliament should be whether it should rather consider a media-specific competition and anti-concentration law rather than relying on competition law to achieve diversity, as it would seem potentially to be quite a blunt instrument. And as I said, we're not advocating this as a particular position because we haven't taken a position on it, but it's an option that we need to consider and debate. A law like this could address the following very basic question. How should media ownership be structured to distribute speech opportunities in society more fairly? A related question. How should communicative power be redistributed to further a democratic society? Now, just in conclusion, for us, a mere focus on the triple B double E scorecard as a measurement of transformation is inadequate. Transformation cannot and must not be reduced to triple B double E. And Gamilpa and Krabbe's definition, which we started out with, strongly implies that. A media-specific diversity measurement tool is needed. Otherwise, we are unable to make any authoritative statements about how diverse or concentrated the media actually are, whose voices dominate, and whose are crowded out. And the last point is that on paper, the ANC especially has supported a policy environment that promotes media development and diversity. And this, together with the efforts of the community media sector in the late 90s and the early 2000s, led to the establishment of the NDDA. But the reality is that the NDDA remains underfunded. And a key point that we'd like to make is that a policy environment that focuses on subsidy only as the main method of achieving diversity, while leaving the basic market structure intact, is going to be problematic. This approach has led to a media environment that provides insufficient spaces for the voices of working class and unemployed people, and for a space that gives more, and for a media that gives more space to middle class and politically centrist viewpoints. And this is a problem that exists not only in the newspaper industry, but in the broadcast industry as well. And I think as we grapple with the question of transformation and to what extent the media is actually transformed, I think we need to look at the entire media environment, not just the newspaper industry, because we're not going to be able to build up a true picture of to what extent we actually have a genuine public sphere in South Africa if we don't look at the multiplicity of platforms that exist in our media system. And this endeavor, I think, should initiate a process where we think afresh about the measures that have been put in place to achieve diversity and how well they are working. But the very last point that we'd like to make is that this process should be participatory and should allow South Africans a meaningful say in what kind of media system they would like to see. And I'd just like to hand it over to my colleague, Julie Reed, who also has a couple of...
Thanks very much. As my colleague said, I'm Julie Reed. I'm from the University of South Africa's Department of Communication Science, and today representing the Right to Know campaign here. Thank you for this opportunity to come here today. I'm really not going to take more than 4 minutes of your time. I'm going to be very brief. And that is because I came here today prepared to speak about media accountability mechanisms. And the Honourable Chairperson has already told us that that's not what we're talking about today. But I'm therefore only going to take you through a very few points. So I'm just going to ask you to bear with me just for a few minutes and then I'll be done. We're going to recognise that the focus of this discussion, as stated in the parliamentary briefing document and as you cleared up for us this morning, entails questions surrounding media diversity and transformation. But we also note with interest that the document that we received last week refers to an independent appeal mechanism to complement the system of press self-regulation in order to promote professionalism in journalism and to discourage bad journalism. So I think if we can say that there was a little bit of confusion over the past few days about what we're going to be talking about here today and whether or not we're going to be talking about media accountability mechanisms, I think that's possibly where the confusion came from. As a contextualization of the discussion surrounding media diversity and media transformation, the parliamentary briefing document raises the matter that there have been recently been many discussions in South Africa regarding and I quote from that document, continuous shabby journalism, declining journalism standards, inaccurate, unfair, and irresponsible reporting, the inadequate powers of the press ombudsman to deter and discourage this practice, continuous non-compliance and non-adherence to the very existing press code, and a lack of accountability from the media. It also stated, I quote, in due course, Parliament will develop an approach on the inquiry into media accountability mechanisms and balancing of the rights as enshrined in the Constitution, including what regulatory mechanisms can be put in place to ensure the effective balancing of these rights. This may include self-regulation, co-regulation, and independent test regulation. So I understand that Parliament is going to take that process further, that there are other mechanisms that will be investigating that. As I said, I'll keep this short, and I'm just going to ask if this committee could communicate these concerns to that or to those bodies when they do start with that process and if they start with that planning. As a campaign, we'd like to note our concern that the debate surrounding diversity and transformation of the media in South Africa has been contextualized under the banner of media accountability mechanisms. We do welcome discussions, of course, surrounding the questions of transformation of the media industry in South Africa and the promotion of a more diverse media. However, we do not believe that an independent appeal mechanism for the press, or more often referred to in popular discourse and ANC resolution documents as a media appeals tribunal, if we're talking about the same thing now, will address any of the real barriers to media transformation and the free flow of information in a society. We recognize, of course, that, as my colleague said, that diversity of the media and the transformation of the media and media freedom are interlinked. We're not sure that a media appeals tribunal is going to solve any of the problems of media diversity in South Africa. We do understand that the ANC, that Parliament and the ANC is committed to an investigation of press regulatory practices, and it concerns us that these particular discussions about media diversity and the transformation of the media have been contextualized under the banner of a media appeals tribunal or an independent appeal mechanism, simply because we do not believe that the process of investigating or instituting a statutory body such as this will address the lack of transformation in our media. So since this indaba has been contextualized in this manner, I'm going to feel that it's appropriate to at least very briefly present the Right to Know campaign's position on press self-regulation or press regulation, the possibility of an independent appeals mechanism or a media appeals tribunal. In February 2011, at the Right to Know campaign's national summit, we took the resolution that this campaign is opposed to statutory regulation of the press and the media. As a campaign, we're currently in the process of finalizing a working document surrounding the issues of the regulation of the press, and these are detailed in the Right to Know campaign's document, which was submitted to you yesterday. The Right to Know campaign is of the position that were a media appeals tribunal to be introduced in South Africa, it would create a significant closure for media freedom, freedom of expression, and therefore democracy, as has occurred in a number of, or it's been a problem in a number of African countries post-colonialism. I'm going to not take you through the majority of my presentation here because, as we've already established, that's not the focus of today's discussion. There's a lot of literature surrounding these issues, and I'll be happy if the committee wants at any point to discuss that with you, but for the interest of time today, we have other things to discuss. What the literature will raise is that there seems to be global consensus on two things that are key factors in this particular debate. And that is that first, there is widespread global consensus that in a democracy, press self-regulation is the best system. Now, as a campaign, I've said we oppose statutory regulation. We're still formulating a detailed concept document of how we feel about self-regulation and so on. But as I said, the global consensus seems to be that in a democracy, press self-regulation is the best system. The second point is that this system, and this is crucial, this system is one that has to be effective. If you're going to have press self-regulation, it must work. Now, in South Africa, we have already achieved the first, and although the second has been cause for recent debate, It's not been swept under the carpet by the self-regulatory system itself or by others. And this is what I would really like this committee to take into account moving forward in terms of any plans that we have for discussion of media accountability mechanisms. And that is that it's important to acknowledge that the debate surrounding the continual alleged shabby journalism in South Africa and supposedly inadequate powers of the press ombudsman has not gone unnoticed in recent months by the Press Council and others. The South African Press Council has been called a toothless mechanism, but it must be acknowledged that the Press Council, largely due to these criticisms, has just conducted a lengthy, costly, and labor-intensive review of its own procedures, structure, and constitution, and in August 2011 released a comprehensive review report of that process. I have a copy here. So for this, I think that the Press Council does deserve some credit. The process of review is not yet complete. The Press Freedom Commission is also currently conducting its own investigation of the matter. So to be fair, it must be acknowledged that the system of press self-regulation is not being taken for granted. It is not going unquestioned, but it is in the process of review and possible improvement, which could lead to the strengthening of the system and a positive improvement of journalistic practice in our country. At very least, I'm going to hope that this committee and others will recognize these efforts and allow this process of review to not only reach completion, but also to be tested in practice for a reasonable amount of time in order to legitimately assess its effectiveness before trying to ascertain whether there is any justifiable need to investigate other methods of regulating the press. So that is what I'm asking for today. To sum up, I just want to leave you with this point. Of the 196 countries surveyed annually for the Freedom House report on press freedom, only 68 countries scored the rating of having an entirely free press in 2011. Only two of these countries were from Africa, and South Africa was not one of them. So this paints a rather alarming picture for us, where as a country, we often pride ourselves on being the shining beacon of democracy on the African continent, and yet we don't have an entirely free press at the moment. Let me conclude by saying that the Right to Know campaign, as the Right to Know campaign, we support journalists and their right to freedom of expression and will, if threatened, work to defend this constitutionally enshrined right of journalists to freedom of expression and the freedom of the media in South Africa. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you very much. We take note of the last part of the presentation. In due course, we'll engage on those matters. But I must say for Parliament, I'm sure Parliament has appreciated and acknowledged the work which is done by the Commission. And to that regard, if my colleagues remember, there has been a statement in the House which further encourage that process to continue. I hope in due course when Parliament takes its own processes, there will be an interaction with those processes and a meet of minds in terms of how to take those matters forward. Members, questions? Honorable Killian, Honorable Drogen.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what is important for us at the start of interaction with the Right to Know campaign is to actually put on record that as members of the committee, we were not aware of the nature and effectively the invitation to a media embargo. We only became aware of it towards the end of last week. And therefore, the document which informed the invitation was at no stage discussed. To the extent that it was, as one of the committee members, an effort that I had to engage with the committee section of Parliament to determine who was invited, what was the nature of the invitation, etc. Only later did I find a copy of the document. I think that needs to be put on the record. Secondly, I think we need to extend an apology for the way in which we've conducted. It was a good idea to start the debate, but I don't think
it was done. It was done with over haste. It was not well coordinated, and I don't think the entire Indaba as such was planned the way that Parliament should have done. I cannot express myself on behalf of other parties, but certainly on behalf of my party, I would like to put that on record. Thirdly, we only obtained the program for today last night, and this morning I had to make a phone call to the chairperson to ask him, could we have a better understanding of who was invited? Could we have a better description of who responded, etc., so that we act in full transparency and that we all understand also the focus of the debate today. So therefore, I want to come to the point that I want to say to the Right to Know campaign, I think it was important that the debate on what do we say, what is it that we are speaking about when we speak transformation. Because if we want to measure success or failure, we need to have a common understanding and we need to determine how are we going to measure success and the decline in diversity in South Africa. That is why it is so critically important to say, what are other countries, free democracies, what are they doing to make sure that communication through media is actually fully representative? It is not possible. I mean, any person who is selling a product, if you, like my colleague next door said, if you're selling fish and chips, you have specific customers. So clearly, but broadly, in order to sustain the democratic debate, it is important for all of us to know that dominance in print media and in broadcasting media of any specific political ideology which does not represent a full debate of the entire country is going to endanger our democracy. And in this respect, I understand that that we must also engage on this issue. If South Africa is to go the route of entrenching democracy and entrenching a deepening of understanding of the right to differ, the right to associate yourself, the right to express yourself, it is going to be important for us to understand that an election outcome at a particular point is just that. It is an election outcome at that point. It is a poll that is conducted. But in between one poll to the next poll, there must be adequate public debate so that the country could be taken forward on critical issues that affect the nation. If we do not do that, the popular uprisings in other parts of the world is what we could face, because we need to give people an opportunity to express concerns, to engage, to highlight problems of non-delivery, etc., also through the media. So I think that is important. I would like to come back to specifically two issues. Just one last comment that I want to make. If we then argue that, and that is what the chairperson this morning said, that the media tribunal issue is not part of the debate today, notwithstanding the fact that it was contained in this document. If we look at the presentation today, I just want to come back to the issue of what is the nature of regulatory measures that were implemented in other countries where there was a disjuncture and one media group became, well, the whole debate about dominance of a group or readership of one particular media group. It could also be in the broadcasting media. I fully concur with Ms. Duncan as far as that is concerned. And what are the measures that they have implemented? You mentioned France. To what extent could we so that we, when we introduce measures, we look at the weaknesses currently as far as NDDA funding is concerned, because you also have to go through process of development so that you have a multiplicity of reporters to develop the content, to express the opinions of communities, etc. So you have to develop there. You have to bring on board university institutions to make sure that they are part of this process. And then also as a government, you need to identify mechanisms that you can mitigate against practices which could be described as anti-competitive, that would cause dominance in a market. And secondly, if we look at South Africa, now, if you are going to speak about France, which is essentially a monolingual country, how do you make sure that in South Africa, where you have a variety of cultures, languages, etc., that you actually make sure that you have that all the languages represented in such a way that you do not deter a good business model that develops on the one hand, but make sure that there is adequate competition. I mean, you focus about 25%, we're standing at Media 24 at 39% at present. And what are the trends that you've identified specifically in the past? You said that in 2000 the picture looked quite differently. There was better balance. To what do you ascribe the change in media ownership? What led to that? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Drogen. But before you come in, I'm told that South Africa is leading 31-0 against Namibia. That's one part. And secondly, I don't want to enter on the issue of the program and so on. The committee adopted the program at the beginning of this term. It was the 27th of July. Now we're in September. So I'll come back with a specific date when the committee adopted the program. But it's a matter we can deal with not here. Honorable Dockers?
Just a point of order, Chairperson. I just want to put it on record. This is the first time I missed a Springbok rugby match in the World Cup since 1995, and I'm very, very unhappy.
My apology that we adopted the program not knowing that South Africa was playing Namibia today. Honorable Drogen?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you. And thank you to Honorable Van der Berg. I think you should have worn your sweater today in support of the Springboks. So I think your heart would have been there. So anyway, you should have worn your sweater today. Or any Springbok colors, or a badge, man. You should have worn that. But anyway, okay. Thanks, Chair. And thank you to the presenters as well. This issue of media transformation is not an issue. It's not a new issue. It's been discussed way back then. I think with when Nat Kenkani was still chairperson of this committee, and I think that was the reason as to why we came up with the NDDA. Maybe like one of the presenters was saying that the NDDA is not funded enough, but I'd like to ask. Is NDDA doing enough? They are not maybe funded, but are they doing enough? Can they do more? That's the one question. Now, media transformation, media diversity, is it the job of NDDA? Are they doing that, or can they do more? That is one concern, because obviously we can see that diversity and transformation is not happening. With our oversight visit to KwaZulu-Natal, for example, the community newspapers were using or printing in Zulu language, and there were quite a few women ownership. And their concern was that there's a push by the bigger media to
to take over the small media, because the bigger media doesn't like the competition in the community, so what they do is they will use other media to buy over that community newspaper, only to find out that that media that actually you bought that community newspaper is actually one of those big medias. So that is a concern for us. We need to encourage the newspapers, community newspapers. When you talk about the big four, when they become a threat to the community, newspapers where they are taken over. And unfortunately, money does play a big role in this sector. So what are you, as Right to Know, doing? I think the presentation is excellent. I really enjoyed it. But what proposal do you have where small communities, are you the voice of those small communities? That's the one question. Because they're feeling the threat by the bigger newspapers. And thirdly, I don't agree that South Africa, we don't really have the freedom of expression here yet in our country. I don't believe that. I still think that sometimes I myself feel that we as people have too much freedom sometimes. You know, we need to define the word freedom. For me, it's about who's in control of the media. And you're talking about the big four. And you were saying that two are owned by white people. So for me, it's about controlling who has the right of expression at the moment for me. That's how I see it. So for me, it's not about having the right to express. It's about having the control, and therefore you have the right to express. That's what I see at the moment happening. So that plays a big role, control and ownership. And then the second presentation, obviously, there's a concern about people on the ground. When big media, there's a negative article and people on the ground don't have the money or the opportunity to defend themselves. I think we need to look at and locate ourselves when we talk. Who do we talk for? Are we talking for those that are on the ground? There are many people that own legal know-how, but the people on the ground don't have the money to defend themselves. The bottom line is who protects the voiceless, those who are on the ground. That to me is important. For example, if there's an article in the newspaper and it was misrepresented, you will find that tomorrow there's a small apology on the last page that we do apologize for the inconvenience or something, but it's not read by many people. So that is my biggest concern. So thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable or Nondaba, Honorable Panova.
Thanks, Chairperson. Notwithstanding what my colleague, the Honorable Gillian, said in her preambling remarks about the process leading to the convening of this Indaba, some of which I associate with, I would like nevertheless to ask the representatives of the Right to Know campaign, how would you have liked to see the process convening this Indaba unfolding? Secondly, who would you have preferred to see represented at this Indaba? And thirdly, what would you have liked to see featuring on the agenda of this Indaba to lead to making this Indaba effective in your point of view? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Panova.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presentation, Right to Know campaign. You've said a lot of things. I just want to focus on actually one or two. It's a pity to hear that South Africa hasn't got a free press. That is unbelievable, shocking to hear that. I also believe we've got a really free press in South Africa, that people can say what they think and what's on their hearts are. But the way forward now, what should we do to get a free press in South Africa? You can change all the owners of the media companies, for instance, but you still don't have a free press. You can change one editor with another editor, and it will still be the same. Something deep inside the whole media thing must change. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Are you ready to respond, Ms. Sanger?
Can I just ask, sister, is it possible to get some water?
Sorry. Before you proceed, I'm told that the tea is coming, and you also need water. Members are requesting a 10-minute break so that they can just have something to drink. So we can break, we can take responsibility in 10 minutes.